This is Barry Peters, recorded at his home at Yaxham near Dereham in Norfolk by Chris Alden Lee on the 1st of September 2010. Barry Peters, Part 2. Let's pick up now, Barry, if we may, with your second spell with Bass. And I'm just wondering how it came about. What happened?
As I say, I was sort of chuntering along quite happily at Marconi, but when GEC took over, the writing was on the wall that things were going to change quite dramatically. And I'm not sure whether somebody contacted me or whether I'd seen something in the paper again about a job in Bass on a permanent basis. But anyway, I got in touch with Bill Sloman, I would think. I can't remember really who it was. And he said, well, come for interview. It's a civil service interview, so there'll be somebody else from NERC on the panel, etc. So anyway, I went for this interview, which didn't go very well, actually, because most of my work was quite highly classified when I was with Marconi. And it's very difficult to answer questions without prevaricating. And obviously, when you do that, I mean, people see through it. So you just, in the end, have to say, I'm sorry, Official Secrets Act. But anyway, I heard absolutely nothing for about 3 months.
Did this job have a title?
Just a logistics officer.
Right, in the head office?
Yes.
Which at that time was still in London?
Was Victoria, just behind Victoria Station. Can't remember the name of the road. I could find it probably. But
and had you had no contact with Bass at all for 7 years? 6 or 7 years?
Very little, if any.
So it was a real...
It was out of the blue a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd still got the wanderlust. And as I've been quite lucky at Marconi's because I've been across to Norway a couple of times and I was out quite a lot of the time from the office.
So did the job imply that you'd be going south again?
Yes. And that was... There was also more money.
detail.
And that was one of the things that irritated me about Marconi, because directly they knew I'd applied, it was, well, I'm sure we can match it. And my attitude was, if you can match it, you should have done it before. Mm. I'm not open to that. And also the lure of going south was obviously...
So I'm sorry, I cut in. You applied for this job, had the interview. It didn't go terribly well.
No, it didn't go terribly well. Heard absolutely nothing and thought, well, that's it, you know, forget it. So anyway, in the end, I think it was Margaret probably pushed me into ringing. And there was stunned, so when I rang Bill and said, look, I've heard absolutely nothing, I presume I haven't got it. And there was a stunned silence. And he said, haven't you heard? And I said, no. So he said, right. So anyway, about 3 days later, there was a letter saying I'd got the job. I mean, partly, I think, although the interview didn't go well because they knew me from Halley, they knew that probably I was capable of more than I was able to give, if you like, at the interview. So anyway, I duly turned up at 90, whatever it was, in Victoria, just behind Victoria Station. And at that time, my boss was Derek Jepps, who you may have met.
Heard about him.
Brilliant. Another wonderful bloke. Ex-Crown agents. Paul Whiteman, who was the senior tech there. Myself. And a chap called David Rampton, who didn't stay with Bass very long. He went to NERC. And at that stage, there would have been Sir Vivian, Eleanor, 3 or 4 secretaries, Eric Salmon, 3 people in accounts, 3 lasses, and ourselves, and Ann Todd, and that was it. And we rushed around and did everything. So all the indents, for example, it was literally a very broad-based job. Not only communications, if you like, but also things, as I say, like post office, all the meteorology, geophysics, anything that came up, some of the biology. So it was a really brilliant job because you never knew quite what you were doing from day to day. And it was always a rush. And I mean, at the last minute, you'd be rushing around buying two gross of AA batteries and things like this out of petty cash, you know, sort of go out to Woolworths waving a huge wad of notes and things and rush around them.
So quartermastering as well, then?
Oh, yes, yeah. doing all sorts of things. So that was the start of it. And then, obviously, that was from 69, and that was the year Bransfield was being built. She was up in Leith, I think she was built, and then she went up to Dundee for the superstructure and bits to be put on. So I didn't go south that year. It was the end of 70 before I went south, or October 70. And I flew down then to Montevideo and picked up the John Biscoe. I think that's as far as I can remember it. And toured all around the bases, obviously most of which I'd never seen, because when you went to Halley, you essentially went, apart from South G, you went to Halley and back again. So, yeah, and the job sort of snowballed from there. At that time, we had our own wireless station, and...
In London?
No, in the Falklands.
Right.
So I linked directly with the chief engineer and the boss of Stanley at that time, Ted Clapp.
When you say wireless station, you mean a broadcasting station?
No, this is purely for communications between...
Okay, I beg your pardon.
And what happened was that, again, when I went back, it had moved on a pace. Well, not a pace, but half a pace. It had gone to teleprinters. So it was quite modern machinery, if you like, compared with Morse code and the key.
So the teleprinters in Stanley were picking up... They were communicating with London?
They were communicating... We had a half-speed circuit, which we shared with FCO.
Was this a wire?
No. No, it was all on HF.
Oh,
HF.
Yeah.
But it was teleprinter HF rather than, as I say, Morse code. Mm. And I think it was a half-speed circuit or a quarter-speed circuit, which we shared with Ezro and FCO. And obviously from that, you've got the political angle coming in from FCO. This was in 70.
FCO is Foreign and Commonwealth Office.
Yes. Yeah.
And the other one was?
ESRO, European Space Research Organisation. And they had a sounder there, an ionospheric sounder, and various other bits and pieces, I think, as well, rheometers and so forth. So, anyway, I did my tour of the bases, 6 months. So went to Adelaide and all round. And I think that was a time... Yeah, when Dick Laws went back as well, I think, in 70. Yeah. I can't remember. I think he was on that first trip. And I think he was being groomed at that time to take over from Sir Viv later on. And then again, I continued doing that for, I suppose, 2 or 3 years. And then it broadened out. They wanted in... No, it must have been 74 or 5. They were closing the Stanley office. Everybody was coming back to UK. So all the clothing stores and everything else had to come back to UK. So they said to me, go forth and sort it all out. So I spent some time in Stanley.
What was the logic behind that?
I'm not really sure. Because it... I mean, there was certainly no redundancies or payoffs as far as I remember. A lot of people went to NERC in Swindon, who were taking much more of an interest in Bass, to the extent where they were starting to interfere a little bit. In general, it worked quite well. We set up, because we, of course, in 75, moved to Cambridge. So we had the stores and we had the huge space, if you like, needed to store boots from size 7 to 13 or whatever, and all the clothing and different sizes. And so I think the feeling was that it was quite expensive to run Stanley as a sort of substation of UK. The radio side of it was being turned over to cable and wireless. I think that was about the same time. And a great friend of mine, again, sadly, who's now dead, Ian Stewart, who was the chief engineer for us, went to Cable and Wireless as manager of Cable and Wireless. And so I spent some time in Stanley getting everything packed up and logging everything, getting it ready for shipping and so forth. And eventually, you know, did a run round the bases and then came back to UK. And that was the sort of life. Little interesting things cropped up. For example, when the Bisco was scrapped, which was a bit later on, there was portraits of the Queen and Prince Philip on board. Now, they have to be sent back to, I forget where it was, but it was some house somewhere that holds all the portraits. So there was me on the tube with two portraits, taking them back to this house, because they're all sort of numbered and logged out and logged in. And so fascinating little things that you don't think about.
Did you meet Sir Anthony Blunt?
No. Not as far as a no.
Wrong era.
And I mean, he wasn't the portrait man, was he? He was the art man. And going to places like taking the Met instruments back to Negretti and Zambra, which is up a little tiny staircase on the sort of second floor of some, I forget where it was now, East End, I think, somewhere. You know, taking Met instruments back. That was quite fascinating too, seeing how companies worked in those days.
The word logistics does sound like a catch-all, doesn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. And it was none the worse for that, because you could turn your hand to anything, you know, buy anything. You just looked in the book and found what you wanted or who made what you wanted and then rang them up and chased them. You know.
Were you ever aware of budgetary pressures when organising all these stores to go south?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that still exists now, of course, to an even greater extent. I mean,
it is now, of course, but I'm just wondering whether there was a more relaxed air about it in the 60s.
Yes, 70s. There was, but I mean, the budgets were so much smaller. I mean, FIDS existed on about £1 million a year, you know, and now you look, I mean, James Clark Ross cost, what, 38 million just to get it off the yard without all the junk they'd put on it, not junk. Scientific gear.
Sorry, I'm leaving about a bit. I do apologise. So, when Stanley was closed, everybody came out to London. Presumably, you had to find somewhere bigger to put them.
No. A lot of them went straight to NERC in Swindon. Clem Clements, the stores man, went straight to NERC. Ted Clapp went straight to NERC. A lot of the other people were locals, Stanley people, so of course they just got other jobs.
It's been difficult, actually, I think.
Well, yes and no. Most Falklanders can turn their hand to almost anything. They are an incredibly good bunch in that way. You know, they can go fishing, or they can start up a little market garden or whatever, and that's what the sort of thing they did.
So that closing of Stanley in 70.
It was about 75, I think. Yeah. And again, I need to. I haven't got
any. I'm sure you're roughly right. Was that the beginning of a cultural change, do you think, in the organisation? Because then, shortly after that, there was the move to Cambridge.
Yeah.
Sir Vivian going, Dick Laws taking over.
Yes, yeah.
So we're seeing a sequence here, which began with the closure of Stanley.
Yeah, and all the people, the scientific staff from the universities coming together in Cambridge, which is a tremendous bonus. Because you could wander down the corridor and talk to somebody face to face instead of having to go to Edinburgh or Birmingham or wherever, Monkswood in Cambridgeshire or Bristol for glaciology. And so that was a tremendous advantage coming together in Cambridge. I'm sure that certainly the people from Edinburgh, probably like Joe Farman, Dave Limbert, and a lot of the others didn't want to leave Edinburgh, but in the long run, it was such a bonus for people like myself who were having to go up there and spend 2 or 3 days looking at indents with them and deciding, you know, what they really wanted and making sure that they got exactly what they wanted right. So, from our point of view, or my point of view as a logistics man, it was so much better.
Was there some real resistance to the centralisation of Bath, or did people toe the line?
There was resistance to where it was going to go. Whether it was Plymouth, Southampton or Cambridge, I think were the three favourites. Probably Southampton and Cambridge. And the committee, in inverted commas, who decide these things were mostly Cambridge men. So guess where it went?
Handy for Dick Law's house.
Well, handy for Sir Viv as well. And Charles, and Charles Swithenbank, another brilliant bloke. Great respect for Charles. You know, I mean, he was working at Scott Polar, I think, at that time. Mm. So, it wasn't a bad place to live. Commuting was pretty awful, but there you go, you get used to it. And I used to ride a motorbike. I don't like cars particularly. So.
Did it work, the new HQ?
Yes, it did. It did. And I think it brought people closer together. Because, as I say, you'd see them at Smoko, you know, up in the canteen. And from certainly my point of view, I found I got on with the scientists much better because I could wander down or say to them, oh, can you spare me 5 minutes, you know? Can we just talk about this? What exactly do you want? Because there's nothing like going south and then finding that the bloke had forgotten his batteries or whatever. Mm. You know, so you can, when you see it, and you can say, have you thought of this? Do you need that? So much easier than trying to do it on a phone at long distance. So from that point of view, yeah, it was great.
I missed out a year, didn't I, when you went to All Saints Passage in Cambridge before you went to...
Yes, that was fascinating.
Why?
We had a clothing rep came in, a guy called Sam Seba. Have you heard this one?
No, go on. No, I haven't.
Well, Sam was a little Jewish guy who... was worked out of East London. He used to make all our anoraks, and ventile, lightweight, and sledging anoraks. And anyway, Sam came in, and he walked through the front door, and he said, I know this building. He said, I was here during the war. And he went through the building, and he said, that room was one huge sandpit, and we used to make models in there, various operations. He was with SOE during the war.
SOE...
Special Operations Executive. And most unlikely guy. It was absolutely amazing. Fascinating just to listen to him say, oh, this room was so-and-so. This room we had. You know. But the funniest part was, do you know Alan Smith? Have you talked to Alan?
Big Al?
Yeah, Big Al. Well, one day, we used to nip out to get a bite of lunch or go for a pint or something. Walked out of the front steps in All Saints Passage, and it is quite a narrow passage. And Ann Todd walked out one day and was totally not flying by a bike. You know, students used to hurtle down there on their bikes, which is naughty. So anyway, poor old Ann, she was a bit shaken up. Next day, Big Al walks out of the door, bang! And the bicycle was buckled, the bloke fell on his back and said, what did you do that for? And I went, and he picked his bike up and scuttled off. So, it was a good place to be. It's quite an interesting place to work.
So the closure of Stanley was...
It was about
because
70...
Of
yeah, 74, I think. 70, right. No, it was after that, because the building... I moved straight in and sorted out clothing onto the racking. And so it must have been 75, 76...
It was all part of the centralisation.
But it was, yes.
And did you sense that there was any mistake attached to closing Stanley? Were there weaknesses which emerged because Stanley had gone?
There were... comms were difficult.
How do you mean by that?
Well, we were still... We had by that time, had a full-speed teleprinter link, sort of 50 words a minute or whatever. But... comms could still be difficult because you were still relaying through not just Portishead but other stations, Briley Hill and so forth, through BT. And I don't know that it caused me particular problems. thinking back, I maybe a bit of frustration, but I don't think there was too much in the way of hassle as far as I was concerned.
So you were communicating directly from Cambridge to Halley, for example?
Well, you were linking through, yes. Yeah, I mean, it was linking through the teleprinter to Stanley, through cable and wireless. Then it was linked onwards to the bases.
So there was still a repeater station?
There was still a repeater.
Right.
Okay. And then, I mean, I was going up and down south every other year virtually then. I mean, it's sort of 71, 73, 75, 77, 79, 81, etc., etc. And, I mean, obviously, it wasn't wonderful, but it was better than we had had. You like.
What were the big leap forwards in communications?
'81, we started looking at Marisat, which is the maritime satellite communication system, which was essentially an American thing. And Marisat was very strictly controlled to maritime ships only. Now, being a maritime equipment, it was fairly bomb-proof. It was encased in a dome, and we looked at that in 81, and in 82, I think early in 82, or maybe late 81, there was a conference in London, and Inmarsat was formed, which is the International Maritime Satellite Systems. Now, Inmarsat, again, was essentially maritime, but we got hold of, I don't know whether it was BT, and talked to them and said, look, this is the only system where, with any luck, because it existed on three satellites at that time, and from Halley, the angle of into the satellite was pretty low. It was only, you know, 2 or 3 degrees, so we weren't even sure whether we were getting any coverage or maybe 6 hours coverage or 9 hours coverage, etc. But it was worth a shot. So in 82, so we mulled it, we were mulling it over at that time in 81. In 82, of course, the Falklands War changed everything. I mean, there was virtually no communication with the bases because it was all linked through cable and wireless in Stanley. And they just pulled the plug. And I was sort of linking through cable and wireless London and saying, look, can you get your Bermuda station to listen out for the bases? And what we did was set up a ham rig. Dick Cressman had an amateur rig. So we put a big V aerial right across the quadrangle of the old, you know, the old U-shaped Bass headquarters at Cambridge, where it used to have a pond in the middle. I think it's all grass now, probably. We put an enormous V aerial out there, and my office was right in the middle of this U on the upper floor, so we put it in there. And we'd sit there at maybe 9, 10 o'clock at night, trying to get hold of the bases or just broadcasting to the bases, saying, you know, keep broadcasting, somebody's going to pick you up, which they duly did. And I mean, I'd get home and at 2 o'clock in the morning, just be sound asleep, and there'd be a call from Bermuda or wherever saying, oh, we've just picked up Adelaide or South Georgia, not South G because that was RG at that time, but Adelaide or Sydney, you know, could never get Halley. But at least if we could then relay a message back, we could say, well, can you let Halley know, or can you find out if Halley's okay? And they come back and say yes, you know. So several nights I'd sort of up at 2 in the morning talking to Bermuda, making sure everything was okay, which they were.
This was April 82, during the actual war itself.
This was during the actual conflict. And that really decided us. And the aftermath of that, of course, was more money. And we went ahead and bought 2 American-built systems, Scientific Atlanta systems, through Ferranti in Aberdeen, and based them at Halley and Cygne. And they worked extremely well. I mean, they were very big and cumbersome by comparison with the later equipment, but at least they worked. And we had fax communication. We were the first people in the world, I think, to use fax as a regular form of communication from the Antarctic, which was good, you know.
That's smiling because it's redundant now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, totally. I mean, I can sit here and ring up Hallie on the phone, you know, I mean, it's how it's moved on. But yeah, it was big news at that time.
So how was the fax? How did the fax work? I mean, I know how faxes work, but how do you get a fax into the machine in Cambridge and come out with the machine in Halley?
Well, it linked through BT at Goonhilly, and it was intercepted. All the messaging was intercepted by the maritime aerial at Goonhilly, BT, and then wired up straight to us. Now, in some ways it was a blessing, in other ways it was a nightmare. Because, of course, the bases could complain about every little thing, like they'd run out of cocoa or whatever, and expect you to answer them straight away. I mean, it's even worse now, because even before I left, I was doing emails by the yard. So it does have its downside, if you like, this instant communication. But anyway, the following year, 83, we did Adelaide, and where else did we do? We did two and two, and we also did the ships in the second year using faxing. That was Magnavox equipment and fax machines, and also I think they started doing data. I mean, the main reason for going to satellite, not the main reason, but one of the major reasons, was of course getting data back from the scientists. And very shortly after fax came in, maybe only a year or so, they'd started doing slow-speed data. And that's obviously got faster and faster and faster. So they can now reel off results, you know, daily, if you like, or nightly, to have it sitting on scientists' desks that morning, which is brilliant.
You know? So, but the turning point then was the fax machine. That was a...
Yeah, that was a forerunner of the data streaming.
And that was the first digital communication, I guess, was it?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And Bass was early in embracing the digital world.
Yes. Not only through me, but because the scientists were clamouring for it. And so, I mean, they put a lot of pressure on. And I know when I went to a SCAR meeting in Germany, at Bremerhaven, and they were quite staggered we were starting to use facsimile. It wasn't a wonderful medium because it was prone to error, but it was better than 50 words a minute teleprinter. I mean now it's even better because you can just ring up and say, oi, what do you mean?
What are your memories of April 82 in the Bass HQ? And I hear stories of major generals tramping up and down the corridors, because the army arrived, didn't they? Really? Well, the services arrived, I should say.
Yeah, I didn't have much to do with that. That was really for the Hyhedians. That was, as I say, Ray Ady and Charles, very much involved in that.
But were you aware of an atmosphere at that time?
Oh, sure, yeah. Everybody was on tenterhooks, I think, especially with South Georgia, for example, where we knew that there had been major problems and people had been carted off. The interesting thing as an afterthought on that one was, of course, Cindy Buxton and Annie were down there at that time.
And Todd?
No, Annie, I forget her other name, Waters?
Okay, I'll give you that, don't worry.
Yeah, Cindy being who you possibly know. Father was Lord Buxton, Anglia Television.
Right.
And Cindy was filmmaking down there in Hound Bay, I think. Can't remember where. So, of course, that caused a little bit of panic and consternation. But they were okay, fortunately. But, yeah, there was an atmosphere, and, I mean, everybody was quite concerned, obviously, about what was happening. I mean, me especially, with regard to the communications. And because Ian and his wife were great friends of ours, Margaret and myself, they used to stay with us when they came back on leave to UK, and I used to stay with them when I was in Falklands.
Ian, second name?
In Stuart.
Right.
I mean, essentially, that is what caused Ian's death, because he had a very rough time. He was manager of Cable and Wireless by then, and so he was our ex-senior engineer. And he refused to give up his office to the Argentinians and used to go in every day. And they used to drag he and his wife out 3 o'clock in the morning on their front lawn with a gun to the back of the neck. Why are you hiding all these men? And, you know, being totally stupid. But eventually he took to drink. It was very sad.
When did he pass away?
Went to his funeral. He was buried in this country. Oh, his ashes were scattered in Scotland. 10 years ago. No. Margaret might remember. I think it was probably before I retired. So he must
late
have
been, 90s.
Yeah, yeah, sort of mid to late 90s.
He was refusing to leave his office?
Sure, he said, this is my office. So they had an intelligence man standing at his back all the time, you know, because the Argies took over. I mean, there are all sorts of things which I know but can't sort of say too much about.
Okay, I understand.
I don't think it's particularly top secret, but they're things that I was told by Ian, so I mean it's hearsay if you like. But he had a pretty rough time. And
was he broadcasting?
No, what they did was, I don't know whether it was Ian or his engineer, who was another ex-FID, and I can't remember his name. When the Argies started using the equipment to communicate with Argentina, what they did was linked, it was an old plug board system, they linked all the plugs together so that it went straight into UK. But that is, you know, what I'm told. So for the first month, until it got too dangerous and they got their own communications people in, every message that was sent was going straight into Briley Hill and thence into wherever.
And that was something that Ian Stewart did off his own?
Well, that's something that he and as I say, his engineer cooked up. That's something they did.
That was their initiative?
Yes.
Very useful, wasn't it, I would think?
I would think it probably was, yeah.
He was taking a risk?
Yes. It got very dangerous, I think, so they had to pull the plug on it. As I say, when the Argies got their own comms people in. Mm. It took them a while. There was one guy there who I knew, one Argentinian, a chap named Vicicomodoro Bloomer Reeve. And I happened to fly into BA to link from a flight to Comodoro and then to Stanley at the time that they were shoving Perón out of power, Eva Perón. And it was quite hairy. You know, I mean, there was all these youngsters with their knuckles on the ground and submachine guns wandering around. Not nice at all. And I got into, eventually found the agent and got out of the airport. We were stuck on the tarmac in Montevideo for about 4 hours, and then they opened the airport to incoming flights at Ezeiza in BA. And anyway, there was another lassie from Stanley there waiting to collect a daughter who was at school in UK, and she knew this guy quite well, and he wanted to take his this was before the fracas, before the Argies moved in. He was one of the people that worked in Stanley, presumably covertly sussing out all the airport and so forth. And he was taking his family back to the Falklands for Christmas. He was one of the few Argentinians I've ever known that has loved the Falklands. But he was in contact with Sadie, and because we were stuck in BA, all the internal flights were clamped down because the military were taking, the junta was taking over. And he said, don't worry, he said, we'll wait a couple of days and we'll get out, because I want to be back for Christmas. So anyway, in a couple of days, they started flying again. I don't think, whether he had any influence on it or not, I don't know. Anyway, we all flew out. We got to Comodoro, and he said, come out for an evening meal. And he and his wife are lovely people, spoke beautiful English. And as you heard, it's an English, no, well, double-barreled name, if you like, Bloomer Reeve. So he's Anglo-Argentinian. And took us to this lovely little restaurant we'd never sussed out on the beach at Comodoro, had a super meal with him and a really nice chat. When he was there in his capacity as a sort of senior intelligence man during the Falklands conflict, some of the people that worked at the for Cable and Wireless and a lot of others, he had shipped over to the other island, to the West Falklands, because he said, if I don't get you out, you're going to do something silly and you'll get shot. And he said, I don't want that, because he knew them all. So he said, I'm sorry, but for your own good, we'll shove you off to the other island. So he saved a few lives. You know, he was a reasonable guy.
Just give me his name again, Stoney.
And it was VC Commodoro. He was an Air Force Commodore, if you like. Bloomer Reeve. Carlos Bloomer Reeve. And he was one of the good guys. But, you know, the Argies are so daft. I mean, I sat down with the agent one night a few years before that and worked out it was cheaper to wallpaper his flat with peso notes than it was to buy wallpaper. And that was the way inflation was going. Mm. And yet they're sitting on a gold mine. Sorry, we're getting off the beaten track.
After the Falklands War, Margaret Thatcher showed a greater interest in Bass than before.
Yes.
Were you aware of what was going on at number 10? Was it obvious to you that there was going to be more money around? And were you getting any to spend?
The answer to that is, it was filtering through that we were flavour of the month. And yes, we did get a lot more money to spend, which enabled us to update a lot of our equipment, both HF, because we were still using HF between bases, and VHF, ground air VHF, maritime VHF. So there was a lot of equipment, and it did enable us to bring it up to a reasonable standard. So yeah, it did filter through, and hopefully it was, you know, it did improve the situation. And now, of course, you can use Iridium or whatever and have your phone in the middle of nowhere, sort of 1,000 miles from the nearest ship base or anything else, and ring home. Whether they use Iridium on official basis or whether people buy their own, I don't know. This is a satellite, 66 satellite system. I don't know whether you use it or have used it.
I've heard it being used.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Arctic, actually.
Yeah.
Let's just look at one or two of these anecdotes about your going back to the Falklands again, because, back to the Antarctic again, I beg your pardon. There was a rather historic flight which you were connected with in some way across the Antarctic from Adelaide to Halley and back again, and you picked it up halfway.
Well, I picked it up at Halley with Sir Vivian Fuchs and Derek Gipps, and Vivian travelled with Bert, and I travelled, and Derek travelled with Dave.
Bert was Bert Conchi and Dave was Dave Rowley.
Dave Rowley. And it was a case of running up and down the runway to bed it in, because it was all powder snow, soft snow. And then, can you two sit right at the back so we can get ski off the ground? But in later years, of course, we had this little joke where we used twin otters as airfix kits. You know, they sent them down hole and we sent them back in kit form, because they used to blow over and do all sorts of funny things. But, yeah.
Tell me the story.
What, of the flight?
Yeah.
Oh, that was just boring. I mean, it's
well, taking off, I meant.
Yeah, because once the aircraft's been stopped on the snow for a little while, it obviously beds in and it sticks to the snow. So you start off and you just can't get up flying speed. So normally what you do is go up and down and back and up the same tracks, ski tracks, to bed the snow in and get the snow sort of fairly compact.
Like a garden roller.
Yeah, that's right. And then get the CFG as far back as you can so you can lift the front ski and get airflow under the wings, obviously, so you can take off. So it's quite a hairy business. The worst one was Adelaide, because you just fell off the end of the cliff. You know, you just went over the rise in the cliff and dropped towards the water before you, like taking off from an aircraft carrier, I should think. But no, when we reached Fossil Bluff to refuel, as I say, I was walking alongside Sir Vivian, because we both landed fairly close together, and walking up to the hut for a cup of coffee, and went straight into a mouth pool. Wound up to my waist in water. Fortunately, it wasn't that deep, otherwise I'd have disappeared, you know. And there was poor old Sir Vivian chatting away, as we go glug, 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 squelch, squelch. But no, there was stayed at Adelaide a little while and then picked up the ship and came home.
That was the first one. Flight from one side to the other.
Yeah.
And what precipitated?
About 9 hours. I think because the boss needed to get out. I think Sir Viv needed to be at home.
He was in Halley?
He was at Halley with us, yeah.
Right, so he had to come down on the ship. The boat.
Yeah. And it was quicker. And that was the year, as you say, that the ice fell on the ship.
Well, tell me about that as well, because that was... We're talking about 1971, aren't we?
Yeah, right. We just left. We were up on base, which was quite a way, of course, from the ship. But apparently it shoved the ship right out into the centre of the bay, pushed all the bulwarks in and rails and things, and had a lot of ice on deck, which everybody busily shovelled off. So quite lucky. But that was the year that we were right under the ice cliff. I mean, it wasn't a case of getting down onto the ice, it was a case of getting on the boat deck and walking across a gangplank onto the clifftop. So it was quite a weight of ice fell on it. Carved off and, you know, keeled over on top of it.
In ice and men, Fuchs reckons it was a very lucky escape.
It was.
How do you mean?
If it had been a huge lump, it was big enough to cause the ship to go right over. If it had been a huge lump, it would have just turned it straight over. And unlike a lifeboat, it isn't self-righting. That would have been a major, major, major catastrophe.
Well, the other stroke of luck was there were no men working.
No, we were quite lucky in that way. And no tractors near the edge either. You know, they all disappeared. But as I say, I was up on base. We didn't hear about it really until afterwards.
Mm. Tell me a bit about Sir Vivian Fuchs, because you did know him. You had to work with him quite a lot. And I'm always interested to hear what people's views are of him. He seems to be a man of mixed qualities.
I, very much the leader. But he used to come and... The thing I liked, he used to tell you what was going on. He'd come into the logistics office and there'd be David Rampton, Derek Gipser come in, myself, Paul Whiteman. And he'd sit on a desk and he'd say, right, what are we going to do about this? And you could all put your two penneth in and then say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Now, he could have picked up your ideas, or he could have decided that, no, he'd go his own way. But at least he let you know what was going on. One interesting thing, when it came to buying a twin otter, because we've been flying beavers and single otters, when it came to buying a twin otter, there was a lot of resistance. And from, I don't know from who, FCO or whoever, but they wanted us to buy a short Skyvan, which has got no clearance at all. You know, its wheels are virtually right under the bottom of the body, if you like. Not good if you're hitting sastrugi, because it rips the bottom out of things. So anyway, Sir Vivian was discussing that with Paul, who was an aircraft engineer. And he said, you know, I'm going to sort this out. So anyway, off he went. About an hour later, Paul got a phone call saying, go ahead, call de Havillands and tell them we'll have a twin otter. That was the sort of influence he had.
Who was Paul?
Paul Whiteman. So, a man of very great influence.
Was that because he started it, or because he was just that kind of guy?
Well, he didn't start it, but he was just that sort of guy. And he had very good political connections. He had quite good royal connections. You know, he used to go to dinner in Buckhouse and things like this. Pretty authoritarian, if you like.
Authoritarian.
Authoritarian, that's it, beg your pardon. In a way, was very much of the old school, you don't drink too much, you don't smoke, I mean, he used to smoke a pipe, but, you know, you don't have to be scruffy to be tough, that sort of mentality. But I didn't find that daunting in any way. I felt he was a good boss. At least you knew where you were with him. And the same with Dick. I mean, Dick Laws, I remember there was a big ruckus with NERC. NERC wanted to influence us much more than Bass wanted to be influenced. I remember I was working away one night about 9 or 10 o'clock at night doing an indent for some satellite equipment for spares. I mean, we used to send a big spares package down, obviously, because in the days of satellite, as it is now, it's a throwaway society. If it goes wrong, you can't repair it. It's a case of another black box goes in. It's like your mobile phone. If that goes fut, what do you do with it? Throw it away and buy another one. And I was working away doing a spares indent for two later equipments we bought. And anyway, Dick had been working, been trying to do a bit of research, I think, on the side. And he came in and we were just talking, and he was saying about NERC being a bit of a pain in the backside. And I said, well, can't we declare UDI, you know, as a joke? And he said, well, you know, we'll give it some thought. But that was the sort of thing you could do with Sir Viv. You could talk to him, or with Dick. And with Barry. I mean, Barry was another very good, I thought, very good boss. So I've never had any problems with him.
How was Fuchs with the rank and file?
Well, I was rank and file. He was very good with the FIDs, but I mean, I was an ex-FID. Essentially, he was an ex-FID. So I mean, he knew all the dodges and all the ins and outs. But yeah, very fair. I don't never had any trouble. As I say, he could be a bit stern, but fine. He didn't like to see people on the ship getting sloshed, which is fair enough.
Huh? How did Bass change with the change of from Fuchs to Dick Laws?
Well, this is when, I think, because Fuchs had so much political clout in high places, NERC never tried to put their finger in the pie. I think when Dick took over, they thought they'd found their...
Achilles heel.
Yes. Mm. And I remember Dick, we got stuck on Bird Island one year. We'd gone in for the day, and 17 days later we got taken off because it just blew and blew and blew. There were 17 of us living in Bird Island Hut, which was quite interesting. And we had Dick had a tell through saying that NERC were doing this, that and the other. And I remember it's the only time I've ever heard him swear. So it was obviously at that time there was a lot of political shenanigans going on as well between NERC and Bass. And of course, I don't know what's happened, but there was rumour recently that NERC were taking over all the logistics.
I don't know.
Away from Cambridge. I hope to God it's not true, because that takes us back to the era when the scientists were all over the place, and there was a little headquarters in wherever, in London. It brings up the same problems, you know, communication.
What was your rank when you left? Have you risen through the ranks to become...
No.
Something important?
I was still... No, I was still a... I don't know.
When you retired?
I started off as a professional and technical officer, and then went to HPTO, I think it was, higher. That's how I finished up. That's the only thing that rankles, because interesting thing, when I was retiring, and they wanted a replacement, and I said, you've got to live with the guy that replaces me. You choose him. I don't want anything to do with it because it, you know, it's your choice. Mm. And a few days later, after the adverts had gone out and come back in a few weeks, my boss came down the corridor and he said, have you seen these salaries? And there was only one that wasn't earning more than 10,000 more than my post. And that really hacked me off a little bit, because I've been flubbing my guts out for 28 bloody years. Excuse me. That's my only beef. But there you go. You know, I'm not bitter about it. It just irritated me at the time.
We talked when we were having coffee, a tea earlier, about loyalty.
Yeah.
And yeah, some of your anecdotes involve still being there at 10 o'clock at night and being rung at home at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah,
so
there is that
you
loyalty.
Clearly had, you personally had a great loyalty towards Bass. Was that unique, or was that a general?
No, I think a lot of people did. Some people became disillusioned. Paul Whiteman, I know, did, and for a very good reason. And I can think of one or two others who found it not to their liking. It changed quite dramatically. It got very much more hierarchical in a way in later years, and I think this is why another colleague of mine left. And I know, as I say, John, my friend from Kyle, outside Kyle, he was, I think, fed up with it. Of really, you get to a point where there's no progression, if you like, as well, and that tends to rankle. And I say too late, I realise that maybe I should have jumped up and down a bit sooner. But I mean, okay, it's hindsight, and it's water under the bridge.
Did you remain loyal right through the late 90s, or
until you were shown the
advert?
The last 3 years I found quite difficult, but not that didn't impinge on my loyalty. That was because my boss had a habit of saying after the event, "Oh, by the way, I've just taken 5,000 out of your budget," which I'd probably got earmarked for a piece of equipment. That annoyed me, and that did cause me to swear occasionally at him, which perhaps is why I didn't get any promotion. But, you know, you stick up for your corner. Most people, I think, are pretty loyal.
Why was there such a high degree of loyalty in the earlier years, would you say?
It's almost like, as I say, being in the services, where you're loyal to your mates, your friends, the people you work with, live with, go sledging with, you know. You've got to be pretty good mates then, because if there's an accident, you know, this is where your loyalty counts, and theirs to you.
So the loyalty on the ice seem to transfer yourself to the...
Well, don't forget that many of the people that worked on the ice in the early days, virtually all of them, had worked together down south or been on different bases down south. But we'd all had that same experience of being FIDs. You know, and that counted for quite a lot.
So even when those people came back to Cambridge from their later years...
Oh, sure,
years,
yeah.
That survived, that loyalty.
Yes, yeah. And the same between the scientists and the GAs and the people like myself. You get flack when you went onto a base. You know, you expected it. Why can't we do this? Why haven't you bought that? And so forth and so on. But well, that's part of the game. And you always get pushed, you know. And you just fend it off as best you can.
How do you view Bass's status today? We're looking at the autumn of 2010. Is it still on the up now, or is it peaked?
I don't know. We used to do a lot of science for very little money. Now, I've been out of it for 12 years, so I can't really speak after that, because the only thing I get is the Bass Club newsletter 3 times a year or whatever. I very rarely attend a reunion. The one I'm sorry I missed was the Halley 50. But that was for other reasons. So whether we are whether our value for money or Bass's value for money is as good now as it was in the early days, I don't know. I think err on the side of saying no, it's not as good. But I have no rationale for saying that. It's just there seemed to be an awful lot of money floating around. And the science has got very much more sophisticated. But whether it's producing any more, I don't know. So, yeah.
Milking time. And the reputation of Bass, do you feel that still stands up?
I would hope that still stands up, because it was extremely high. Mm. Extremely high.
At what period would you say it was highest?
Oh, gosh, in the 60s and 70s, certainly. Probably the 80s as well, amongst the scientific communities. And we had very high-calibre people. I mean, people like Dick Laws, Roy Piggott, Charles Swithenbank, Ray Ady. You know, they're all top guys in their own field. I would hope. I know they're all retired. Well, Charles hasn't. I don't think Charles will ever retire. He was off to the Arctic last time I talked to him at Roy's funeral. And he was off to the Arctic then. He was going up to Spitsbergen, I think. And I'd been up there the year before, funnily enough, just on a jolly, on a cruise, which was quite fascinating. Interesting that it's very different from the Antarctic. I enjoyed it, but it is, I'd love
to... In what way is it different?
The terrain is different. The scenery is different. I only visited Nielsen. I'd love to have stayed there. I think it'd be brilliant. But unfortunately, the guy I know was due in a week later. We were on a cruise ship, so I mean, I couldn't have stayed anyway. But I'd like to have seen him up there.
What is it about the polar regions that shapes a man? I mean, almost impossible to answer this,
but yeah.
How do you think your life has been shaped by your time in the Antarctic?
I think it does instill a sense of partly a work ethic, but also loyalty. I think those are the two things. Being able, in theory anyway, to turn your hand to a lot of things. I know my plumbing needs sorting. I'm quite good at rotting out drains.
I was thinking the finer aspects of humanity rather than just toiletry.
I don't know. I think it's being able to get on with people as well. I think you learn that on base more than anything else. Even if you perhaps don't have much in common with somebody, you have to get on with them. There's no point in... I mean, the only person I've known we've had to sack was somebody who pulled a knife on somebody. And that didn't go down very well. I mean, that wasn't while I was there. It was something that happened, and I happened to go into the base after it had happened. I don't know. I think, I mean, it's like people like still being able to talk to Ricky Chin, for example, who I never wintered with, but we seem to get on really well. I've known him a long time. I can pick up the phone after 6 months, and it's as if I'd talked to him yesterday. The same with John up in Kyle. You know,
John Newman.
John, yeah, I never wintered with him, but we got to know each other. He worked in the office for Bass. And so he took early retirement. He'd had enough. Reasons for that, I don't know. I think he just got fed up with the bureaucracy. And it's become much more bureaucratic. You haven't got the freedom to, say, rush off with a fistful of fivers and buy things at the last minute and then pile onto the ship with them, you know. Yeah. That's about it, I think.
I think so. You've done very well. Thank you very much, Barry.